Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
You know, we've talked a lot about the one-year anniversary of that Russian invasion of Ukraine. And Carol, I did not know about this until reading this story. Mm-hmm. But President Vladimir Putin, he begins the war. A network used throughout Europe, including by the Ukrainian military, then faced an unprecedented cyber attack. And it's one that everyone is finally talking about.
Yeah, I feel like it went from no one to everyone, yeah. And they should be. This story is coming up in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands tomorrow, already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. And of course, on the Bloomberg. Let's get to it with Bloomberg News cyber and emerging tech reporter Katrina Manson. She joins us via Zoom in New York City. And of course, we've got the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber, right here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So tell us about this hack.
In my ongoing propaganda for RTO messaging, Katrina and I found ourselves in the Washington, D.C. bureau. And Katrina was like, have you heard of this company Viasat? And I was like, what are you talking about? She was like, it's a satellite company. I was like, I don't know anything you're talking about. And it turns out that there was a hack at the beginning of the Russian invasion. And no one initially attributed that to Russia. But as the weeks passed and Western governments, you know, finally got around to pointing a finger, they pointed that finger at Russia, which obviously Russia says, we're innocent. But what it really revealed was something that I thought was worthy of further exploration, and Katrina did a great job on this. And it turns out satellites are really unsecure, and that is a little frightening when you think about the amount of data that is sent there. And so this Viasat hack that you read about, Katrina, tell us why it ended up being a much overdue wake-up call for the satellite industry.
Well, I think tracking it down was so fascinating. Reports came out in dribs and drabs. There were other journalists who are very obsessed with this issue who were, of course, covering it. But it was very hard to put together the overall picture. And some cybersecurity researchers did incredible work really trying to encourage the company to talk about this in public. And when I say cybersecurity researchers, I mean hackers. They have been trying to hack space for a decade plus for white hat reasons. That's classically known as for good, to share that information so other people improve. But it's a really sensitive area. And so one of the main people I spoke to for this story, Ruben Santamarta, he's been warning since 2014 that space is insecure. And he said to me that page 10 and 11 of one of these very esoteric papers that he'd written actually essentially predicted exactly what happened to the Ukrainian military, which relies on commercial satellite in remote places to get their internet connections. That's essentially how they want to link frontline troops to command and control, to controlling drones, all the things that you would need to respond to a very swift, or what was intended to be a very swift lightning invasion by the Russians. So the stakes were incredibly high. And it came down to a lot of researchers who've been clanging the bell for this for so many years. Another one I spoke to, called James Parvel, for the story, he intercepted satellite data transmissions. That's from the satellite down to, in this case, ships that were relying on satellite connections. And he got hold of crew manifests, passport details, credit card details. It is extraordinary how much out there in space is not encrypted and how easy it is to get hold of it.
See, and I was so hoping she was going to talk about Captain Midnight, but we'll get to that later.
I mean, we have to. We have to. I mean, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the U.S. intelligence on this. The U.S. looks into it, gleans that the Russians were prepared to take significant diplomatic and strategic risks, which feels like something that you could have told us before the U.S. intelligence looked into that, but Katrina. But I wonder if you can talk about how much the U.S. knows as we stand today and maybe the extent to which we don't know.
Well, I can tell you what I know, which is definitely not everything. But I think the U.S. Worked fairly quickly within about 4 weeks to work out that they thought it was the GRU that's responsible. That's Russian military intelligence. They have allegedly done lots of hacking, according to the U.S. in the past. And what was interesting about that was that it was coordinated with the invasion. Now, once they established that, they then spent 6 weeks trying to convince the Europeans that they were right. And I think it has interesting echoes for the rest of how the US approached the Ukraine invasion, which was to flag early on to the Europeans, look, this is going to happen. We have the intel. And the Europeans, namely the French and Germans, said, no, we don't think so. Mm. And the in the case of the satellite hack, the US actually went above and beyond and shared additional intel, I'm told by a European official, with the French and the Germans to try and convince them not only that this had happened, but that it was really important to blame Russia in public. Yeah. And that's something countries simply don't usually do.
Well, as you say at the end of the story, you have a quote from a source who says it is super, super repeatable. So that's distressing.
I was going to say the good news is that this will never happen again. Right, Katrina?
I may well be invited back, I'm sorry to say. Mm.
So walk us through what has to happen in order for this to not happen again.
I think at the most extreme end, some groups in the U.S. are calling to make space systems a critical infrastructure sector. I mean, that is terrible jargon. I'm sorry to even introduce it. But it's essentially to say, give this sector way more prominence, government support, and essentially potentially regulation. That's something satellite companies mostly don't want. And I think the US government isn't going to do that. It would require Congress to step in. It's part of a five-year review. I mean, it's just going to get sucked into all sorts of, you know, bogged down into stuff. But the easiest thing to do is to set standards. And that's actually what the source who said this is super, super repeatable is doing. He wants international countries to agree, well, how do we run our satellite systems? What do we do with the satellite up in space? How do we control the link? What goes into the ground network? And as you have more and more satellites going up into space, I mean, the numbers are, can I say astronomical?
This is the best part. Yeah. What do these numbers look like?
Yeah. I mean, it's from about 5,000 active satellites in orbit at the moment to within the next 7 years, the high-end predictions are 100,000. That's because satellites are getting smaller, launch is getting easier, everyone's into this new low Earth orbit, which is much closer, so easier to get to. The satellite that got hacked was a geostationary satellite, way higher. So you're going to see way more satellites in, which means that if one gets hacked, there are others you can rely on. But I think what's key is establishing standards and working out what goes into that glue and protecting ground networks. I mean, that's actually what the entry was in this hack. And there are really convoluted chains between the different operators of a satellite network. And it seems that the ball got dropped in that case. There was a third party operator.
Right.
That's whose network reached, and it went all the way to Viasat.
It's our new kind of warfare, right? Cyber warfare. And like you think about nuclear deterrence, like how we create that kind of deterrence when it comes to global satellites. Incredible story. Katrina Manson, cyber and emerging tech reporter at Bloomberg News via Zoom. Jill Weber, editor at Bloomberg Business Week. The story in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, so getting to a clean energy world, it is already upending the establishment. It costs a lot of money and it requires a whole lot of new infrastructure. So, Carol, this is going to bring us to our next big story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week. This story takes us to a 211-mile road in the Alaskan wilderness.
Yeah, the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week out on newsstands later on this week. Already on the Bloomberg, this story, you can find it, and also at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. So let's get to it. With us is David Woolman, Bloomberg Business Week contributor. joining us via Zoom in Hawaii, along with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber. He's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. This story fits into another conversation we just had about energy infrastructure and all that it entails. Joel, tell us about it.
Well, what really stood out to us when David pitched us this story was that it starts to look like how the U.S. will try and become energy independent. There's a lot of stuff that we need to achieve that. And, right. You know, we're going to need to continue to import stuff for the foreseeable future. But a little place called Alaska happens to have a lot of resources. But in order to get there, we might need to build a road like 211 miles into the wilderness. And it really speaks to what a complicated idea energy independence actually is. It sounds great. And then it's like, oh, right. How do you get that stuff out of the ground and into, you know, electric batteries for cars? And David, what does that look like in Alaska? And how have we come to a moment where we might be willing to, you know, compromise some wilderness to get some new cars?
Yeah, I first learned of this story because a guy in this tiny truck stop called Coldfoot Camp up there about 60 miles north of the Arctic Circle, he sent me a direct message on Twitter. And he said, you know, there are these helicopters flying in and out of this place all the time right now, doing all this prep work for this very controversial road that would cross some 211 miles through the wilderness to access this long sought after mining district called the Ambler. And he just was trying to sound the alarm about it, saying, you know, nobody really knows this is happening. There are a lot of these controversial infrastructure projects related to mining in Alaska. This one just, you know, doesn't have any Trump family members who are making news about it. And so he felt like, I got to tell someone. And so I flew up there just before the snow in the fall to see this with my own eyes. And you know, like a lot of these big infrastructure debates, you know, it is just as thorny as you could possibly imagine. We absolutely need these minerals out of the ground for the green tech future, and it would be absolutely destructive to an invaluable piece of wilderness. And so, you know, then the question becomes, where do we land on this particular one versus that particular one or Bristol Bay? Because we do need to develop more domestic sources for the supply chain. But, you know, mining doesn't exactly have the most impressive track record when it comes to careful extraction of these materials. And so that was sort of the, again, the really thorny issue I wanted to go see firsthand.
So what's the status of the Ambler Access project currently?
Yeah, it was really like a kind of pipe dream for a long time. You know, geologists have known about this impressive mineral resource out there for generations now, but it was just way, way too remote for anyone to take seriously when it came to the economics of extracting it. Then about 10 or 15 years ago, this idea of building a road connecting the famous Dalton Highway to Ambler, it began to get a little more grown-up attention, I would say. And now that there is momentum from Biden's infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, and of course, Alaska's kind of pro-mining senators, the road has really gotten more of a push. And so now there are some mining firms that have claims both in the Ambler mining district and then all along the proposed route as well, that are just trying to keep inching it forward, trying to please all the various stakeholders. You know, critical among them, I should add, are the Alaska Native corporations, which are, you know, very powerful up there and also own some of the land that the road would travel through. So right now they're doing kind of preliminary groundwork with like studying animal habitat, building helicopter landing zones, and trying to get this environmental impact statement finally permitted so that they can press forward with the thing.
David, can you talk about how the American consumer plays into this? I know in your story you talk about how increased demand for EVs might actually be a helpful solution here.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because this stuff gets so dizzying with the like, should we build it? Should we not? Should we drill it? Should we not? And I paused at some point and just thought about my own life, frankly, and my children saying, hey, you know, can we get an electric vehicle already? Like we should be doing this thing. They're worried about climate change like everyone else. And You know, we noticed, this is more me and my wife than me and my kids, but the tax incentives now, thanks to recent legislation, so that the everyday consumer is going to get a nice rebate if they buy an EV. But there are various rules. Those EVs have to be produced, or I think the specifics are some percentage of the materials and the manufacturing has to happen within the United States in order for the consumer to get that rebate. And so now suddenly, like, beyond Alaska Native corporations, beyond the mining companies, even beyond the legislators, the big push to access these materials might just come from everyday people like me who want to replace, you know, the family's mini SUV with an EV. And I think, you know, that's one of those sort of demand wins kind of conversations.
David, just got about 30 seconds left here. So it sounds, you know, we understand the demand and the need for this. At the same time, it sounds like it could be a mess and impact the climate negatively as a result of building this road. So 30 seconds, that's a big deal. And that's a big part of this story.
It is, you know, and the piece I'd add is the time horizon puzzle, because even if they greenlit this thing tomorrow, no ore is going to be coming out of the ground any sooner than a decade from now. So the question is, like, will our critical minerals 10 to 15, 20 years from now be the same critical minerals we're talking about today?
It's an incredible tension to end on, right? Like the future, like this seems like the future, but like, the future changes.
Yeah. That's, you know? Right. 10 years is a long time, yeah. Certainly when you're talking about this. Incredible story, deep dive. Highly recommend people check it out online or on the Bloomberg or pick up the magazine later on this week. David Woolman, thank you so much. Writer joining us via Zoom from Hawaii. And of course, our thanks to the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. As we said, that new issue out later on this week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So much has come out of U.S. lawmakers. You've got the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. That's more than $500 billion in spending. The CHIPS and Science Act, that's almost $300 billion. The Inflation Reduction Act, that again is another $500 billion for healthcare, climate, energy. We know, Maddie, the U.S. government has put forth some major, major spending initiatives. So with that in mind, we wanted to talk to our next guest about what he is seeing specifically. Delighted to have with us Bob Pragada. He is CEO at the nearly $15.5 billion market cap company, Jacob Solutions. They do engineering, construction services, specialty consulting, and clients really across industries and across the world. They're based in Dallas, but he is here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Bob, good to have you here with Maddie and myself. First up, always good to talk with someone like yourself because you see so much. How would you describe the economic and business environment right now?
I would say that it's what we're seeing. You talked about the legislative kind of undercurrent right now, yeah. Really to stimulate the economy. We're seeing it robust. It's a generational kind of opportunity for companies like ours to take advantage of long history and success within the infrastructure world, the advanced facilities, specifically semiconductor and life sciences, as well as all that's going in the whole energy transition environment today. So this is, in my career, Carolyn, I've never seen anything of this magnitude.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. How do you decide what to do in that situation when you do have that much opportunity? What's your thinking behind like capital allocation and things like that?
First and foremost, a balanced capital allocation program. But really, this is an opportunity for us to grow organically. You know, we made some big transformational moves within our portfolio and the end markets that we serve, the services that we were going to concentrate in on, some digital platforms that we've invested in. And so we're feeling really strongly that this is the time for us to take advantage of some of these tailwinds that we're seeing. And so it's exciting times.
It does sound exciting. So talk to us about tailwinds, because one of the things I love to do, and this is why I also love to play, I know we focus on public markets, but I love private markets, get an idea of the trends that are really taking hold as a result of whether it's the government money or private money. What trends are you guys working with or working on or involved in that you say, okay, this is the future, or these are the things we're going to all be talking about a lot in the future?
First and foremost, climate change and what we describe as climate response. Obviously, in a lot of press on this, it is the global disruptor of all global disruptors, and the way that that then transcends down into the transportation world, the water world, everything about the environment, energy transition, and just how it affects all of our lives globally is the number one. Second, that we've really been focused in on is digital enablement. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to turn into a technology company or a tech company. We're going to stay core to our intellectual horsepower and our science-based consulting. But digital enablement is now turning our whole world upside down, is really enhancing the solutions that we can provide.
Do me a favor, before you go further, digital, what does that mean though specifically? Because I feel like we've been living in a digital world for some time, and I know it can explode in a lot more ways. So what does it mean specifically, if you could?
Why don't I be specific and then I'll give an example.
Yeah, I'd love.
So right now, in the broadest sense, it's the use of software platforms combined with our intellectual horsepower and our services in order to facilitate and enable a more productive or efficient solution. Before, all of that would be done with just us and what we knew about the domain knowledge we had around different facilities or infrastructure, et cetera. Today with software, we can expedite that know-how and use those algorithms to even enhance the solution. And here's an example. We've been in the operations and maintenance world for water facilities, water treatment, wastewater mm-hmm. treatment, forever. These facilities generate a ton of data.
Right.
Conventional means, we'd take that data, and then in the field, we'd make decisions on treatment methodologies, what to do with some of the energy byproducts, et cetera. We're in partnership today with a company called Palantir. Mm-hmm. And with Palantir, as well as our own unique and proprietary algorithms that we've developed, we're enhancing worker productivity by 50% on having the data right in front of you that's already analyzed and ready to go, and our people in the field are able to capitalize on that.
So it expedites things, makes it smarter, quicker, all that good stuff.
Smarter on the smarter front, less deficiencies or defects.
Hmm. Okay. Is there anything within all of the government spending that we mentioned at the top that's helping you achieve some of the goals that you've talked about specifically? And what would you say is maybe the single biggest thing that something like the IRA has enabled you to do?
Specifically on the IRA, I would say it's still probably 3 to 4 months out from being out public. What the effect that it's having in our environmental as well as potentially in the energy transition component. So those programs, whether it be grid modernization or everything that's doing to electrify the world, even to include the electric vehicle ecosystem, that's having a big effect on our business, even prior to the real funds flowing. The other one's the CHIPS Act, which is a big one. And the CHIPS Act is in real time, but what companies, specifically large US companies, have done is they've already announced and have started the design of these facilities. We've been involved with that from the beginning. So the CHIPS Act is going to do nothing but continue to facilitate that growth.
So you're talking about the actual factories, the buildings, and all that?
That manufacture the chips.
Okay.
Yeah.
How far along are we on the impact of both of those? I know you mentioned IRA taking a couple more months. If we're in a football game, what quarter are we in here?
Early first quarter.
Okay.
Early first quarter.
Okay.
I'd say on IJA, the Infrastructure Act, we're in the first quarter break.
We're talking with the CEO of Jacob Solutions, Bob Pergada. One thing I think is interesting, and I feel like these are things, you know, Maddie, that we've talked about a lot, climate change, renewables, bringing, when it comes to chips, more manufacturing back in the U.S. So what you're seeing is that, okay, we've been talking about it for a long time. This stuff is really happening, and you're seeing tons of money going into it.
That's exactly right, and in the early stages. And it probably goes without saying, you know, we have been waiting for this. It got announced a couple of years ago, but how we measure it through our pipeline into actual opportunities and then flowing through our P&L, we're in the midst of that right now.
What does it mean, you think, for the U.S. going forward specifically? I mean, you work globally. So when you look at, we've always talked about globalization and global supply chains, and it does feel like there's pushback, Bob, against that. So are you seeing that?
We are seeing it in a couple of different forms. But here's where Jacobs is a bit different. So you also hear about, we talked a lot about the tailwinds. I think it would be fair to talk about some of the headwinds, things like inflation, the war on talent, these types of issues, labor shortages, et cetera. We've been able to really power through all of that because of our model, which is around optimizing our global talent and utilizing them for local solutions. And that really has been intertwined in our culture of inclusion and diversity, and being a global company that provides local solutions.
Right.
We've been able to really put that into great effect over the course of the last few years, as we've seen these headwinds as well as tailwinds buoy our business.
So even though you're seeing maybe the world push back against globalization, for you guys and your strategy, it's key to have people in the local markets to understand those markets they're working with it, and having people on the ground there, correct? Is that
a
fair way?
It's a fair way of looking at it, while at the same time having global talent for expertise that we may have in Australia or in Southeast Asia and India and Europe, all over.
So I think about, for our investors who are listening to you, and you really do have this incredible vantage point. I wish we had like a half an hour more to talk. What would you say to them as we are in this kind of tricky environment, you know, all the Fed talk, and it's all important, but you've got to be looking years ahead. What would you tell our investor audience about, here's where you need to focus?
Focusing on companies that are not exclusively, but have a heavy focus in those areas with long secular growth trends. We talked a lot about infrastructure.
Yep.
It's a big part of our business, advanced facilities, tech manufacturing. I mean, these are trends that are not 2-3-4 year trends. These are trends that are tied to the digitization of the entire world, the energy transition that we're moving to, and all of our efforts around climate response. I would say investors that have opportunities to invest in those sectors and companies that support those sectors, it's a great investment.
I didn't hear anything about ChatGPT. All right, that'll be the next time.
Maybe Bob, another group of investors.
Bob, thank you so much. Come back soon or join us via Zoom, because love the vantage point, like I said, that you've got. Bob Pregotta, he's CEO at Jacobs Solutions, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Next story has it all for us. Celebrities, fugitives, and even the Fugees. On that last point, Praz Michel, you might remember him as a Grammy Award-winning rapper, longtime member of the Fugees. What you may not know is his role in a high-stakes negotiation between the U.S. and China, Carol.
That's for sure. It is the cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It is mind-blowing. But the new issue out on newsstands now, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek on the Bloomberg Terminal. So let's get to it with Bloomberg News Investigations reporter Anthony Cormier. He joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So I feel like, Anthony, that this story, the more it gets told, the more riveting and the more cinematic it gets. So tell us about the member of the Fugees and the connection with 1MDB.
Right. So, you know, Pras Michel is one of the founding members of the Fugees, the 90s Grammy winning rap act. And he met an unassuming baby-faced Malaysian businessman in 2006 at a nightclub. And his life changed pretty dramatically after that. That Malaysian man was Jolo, the accused financier who's facing very serious charges of embezzling from a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund. And we picked this story up after, Jolo has been charged with, multiple offenses, or he's at least been accused of embezzling money. And he asks for a favor from his dear friend, Pras Michel.
So many different places to go on this one. And I feel like you got to love a story that is not only being told by us and all the esteemed business outlets out there, but it's also being told by Page Six. So let's go to it. First of all, how did these two come together and how did Pras get so intertwined?
Right. Well, Pras had, Pras is a connector. He's the kind of guy who has friends in business and in politics and in entertainment and... Yeah. He meets Jolo at a party and they slowly become friends and they begin to explore these sort of business opportunities together. And Jo found that Pras had connections to the Obama White House. And what they have been accused of is using straw donors to donate money to Obama's 2012 election campaign. Many years go by and Jo is essentially facing a slew of charges, forfeiture complaints, and he needs some help, some representation. He turns to his dear friend Pras and he says, listen, do you have any help? How can you connect me with a lawyer, with representation, so I can, make this thing go away? And that begins the sort of, saga of how Pras assembles a team. He goes to an old friend who connects him with a gentleman called Elliot Broidy, who is a Republican fundraiser from California, and they put together this plan where they intend to influence the new and perhaps chaotic Trump administration.
Right.
They're hoping that they can get an in there. And then things take a turn. They go and they meet with Jo, and at this meeting they're introduced to a gentleman called Sun Li Jun, who is the Vice Minister of Public Security for the People's Republic of China. And they have a big question. They want to see if the Chinese can get back a critic who's living in the U.S. overlooking Central Park. And this gentleman's called Guo Wengli, and he's begun to make all of these absurd allegations about the PRC. And the Chinese want him back. And they say to Pras and his group of friends, can you get him back? And, that leads again to this very unusual set of circumstances.
Well, then what does Pras do after that?
But, there's a number of things that happen in between there. But one night Pras is sleeping and the Chinese, including Sun Li Jun, they're in the United States. They're trying to meet with top members of the White House or the administration.
Yeah.
And they can't get anywhere. The meeting doesn't happen. And so they phone Pras basically and say, get to the Four Seasons on 57th,
the one
right across from our building. Get here now. And he arrives. There's this very cloak and dagger scene where he's told to exit the hotel and circle it twice to make sure I'm not being tailed. And his phone's going in a bag, and he's alone in a room with two chairs. He doesn't have any idea what's going on, and he's basically like, "Oh my gosh, they can't kill me in the Four Seasons."
So let's bring in the editor of Businessweek, Joel Weber. Joel, I mean, I feel like we could just listen to Anthony go on and on about this.
And we will, because who cares about me right now?
No, we do.
The quote that you hit in the story was, they can't kill me in the Four Seasons.
Give me a t-shirt with that on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when you get there, you're like, I'll go ahead and keep reading. And the story, there's so many dimensions of this story, and it just keeps you going until the end, and then you're like, wow, I can't wait to watch the movie about this. But so the next turn in this story is basically going to be when Pras goes to trial, right? So yeah. what are the charges against him that the U.S. is bringing.
Klaus
because
goes to Washington.
He faces campaign finance allegations. He faces violating the what's called the Foreign Agents Registration Act, essentially acting on behalf of a foreign government. He faces some very, very serious offenses. And many of the people who were also charged in this case, they've already, for lack of a better word, they flipped. They're cooperating with the U.S. government now against Pras. But Pras thinks he says he's innocent. He says, I'm not going to accept a plea to a charge I didn't commit. He plans to fight it. And, as far as we can tell, he's going to launch a pretty vigorous defense.
You know, I have to say, we've been looking forward to talking to you. And Joel has been, like, kind of teeing us up and just giving us little nuggets. Because part of this coverage, there's your great story, the three of you, this reporting. But there's also this incredible sidebar that talks about, I said, page six, right? This is a story that we've reported on, all the financial journalists, but also page six because of Leonardo DiCaprio.
And Kim Kardashian. So tell us about that part.
So, as the agents are, as the FBI agents are pursuing Jolo, they want to find out where his money went, what he was up to, and they knew that he partied all of the time with all kinds of A-list celebrities. Leonardo DiCaprio, Las Vegas with Kim Kardashian, the record producer Swizz Beatz. He gave them extraordinary gifts. He had financed the Wolf of Wall Street for Leonardo DiCaprio.
Right.
And so they begin to squeeze these celebrities. And it's you really rarely get a look at the way the FBI treats A-list celebrities. And these documents, our reporting, shows how serious they took these cases. And they brought, in fact, Leo, in his case, they brought him, they sat him down for this long and sort of invasive interview. They brought him back before a grand jury. They went through his emails, his BlackBerry messages.
I mean, L Dog got grilled.
He had quite a lot that he did remember, and then if you read the report from the FBI, there's quite a lot of documents he didn't remember either. And he had a pretty long and extensive history with Joe. And while we know the parties, I think that's been pretty widely reported. What no one has known is how close they became. Their relationship went beyond this sort of, you'll finance my film and you'll come to my yacht, to let's build a $1 billion movie fund. Let's build an eco resort on an island. Let's get money for this or for that. And you've got Leo connecting Joe with all of his buddies. I mean, their relationship was much closer, I think, than the public has known to this point.
Okay, wait. Kardashian.
Kim, okay. Yes.
So, play some poker, does pretty well.
She plays Baccarat, actually.
Does pretty well.
Yes, she does very well.
How well does she do, and what happens with the money?
She does so well that she's up $350,000 in one night. And her security guard, in fact, says, "You got it. Those aren't your chips. You can't take them home." She says, "Okay, I'll give them back to Jolo." Jolo says, "No, they're for you." She doesn't know what to do with this many chips. She walks to the casino counter. They literally give her a bag of $250,000 in $100 bills. They put it in a garbage bag.
That's my favorite part.
She puts it on her. She puts it in her carry-on luggage and gets on a Southwest flight back to L.A.
Wait, which is Southwest? Like, I love you, yeah. Southwest. But
there you go.
That was, I think, too many.
Where was the private
jet? That's your moment
of our
sin right there.
It's beautiful.
You can't make it up. It is perfection.
You're welcome.
All the teeing up was right on the money. Anthony, thank you so much. Well done, the whole team, your investigation. Anthony Cormier, investigations reporter at Bloomberg News. Joel Weber, the editor of Business Week. This is the cover story. It's a must read. You're going to have fun this weekend checking it out. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, "Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So let's talk about the collab a little bit, because, we talk about it so much, Maddie, certainly through the earnings season, whether it was Microsoft, whether it was Amazon. Gartner's got some statistics out there about worldwide spending on public cloud services reaching nearly $600 billion in 2023, up more than 20% year over year.
Yeah, and the next guest that we're going to talk with, Julia White, is going to give us some really good insights into overall cloud market dynamics. She is the Chief Marketing and Solutions Officer and member of the Executive Board at SAP. Julia also spent more than 20 years at Microsoft building out Microsoft Azure, and she is with us via Zoom in Seattle. Julia, thank you so much for being here. I wonder if you can just start off by giving us a background on your company, including the fact that I need to be calling it SAP instead of SAP, which is hilarious because you literally have that in your FAQs on your website.
We've had a crazy, all of a sudden we've had like an earnings dump. So it's like all of a sudden we're going through our notes. So bear with us a little bit.
But I love that you, I was literally just looking at and you have that in your FAQ. So yeah, just give us the background here.
Absolutely. Great to be here with you. And SAP, or SAP, as it's formally pronounced, we provide the cloud solutions for business transformation, right? So you talked about Microsoft in my past life, or Amazon, who have big cloud infrastructures. And SAP provides the business solutions. So for things like finance, management, controlling inventory, supply chain, HR processes, procurement, all the business systems that run companies, those are the cloud services that we build and provide to our customers.
You know, Julie, what's great about talking to a company like you, and we've been talking an awful lot about, Maddie and myself, about IT spending with a lot of our guests. What are you seeing, especially in a global macro environment where there's so much debate about the outlook, Fed policy, you know, the big macro stories that are out there. What are you seeing firsthand in terms of your clients and your customers?
Yeah, definitely some interesting trends. I'd say for sure we've switched into a rigorous process around tech spending, right? There's no more nice to have tech. It needs to be proven. It needs to be able to demonstrate real business value. And you've even seen in the recent earnings round, some of the big cloud infrastructure providers, you know, some of the growth starting to slow a bit because customers bought a lot during COVID, right? They moved a lot of existing business systems to public cloud providers. But that was just basically picking up an existing system and running it in a cloud to get some of the efficiencies, which is great. But now they needed some of that business value to come out of it, not just running it in a cloud model. But you're seeing a lot more decision makers being in the mix as they purchase these things and really saying, like, well, how are you going to help me with inflation? Right. How are you going to help me refactor my supply chain?
That sounds like CFOs are in the equation, or the financial guys are like, okay, great, we want to spend it. Yeah. But tell us how that helps us with the bottom line. Is that fair?
Yeah, way more CFOs in the mix, and really those value cases coming up. Right. And I think the three big ones, right, showing shifting business models, which is a CFO-led conversation. I need to go from selling products to subscriptions. I need full customer lifecycle engagement, right? That's something very hot. Supply chain refactoring, I mean, 20 years of going global supply chain, now we're refactoring all that to be more regional. And then interesting, the last one, despite, you know, controversy or, you know, other things saying otherwise, sustainability, still top concern. Switching to be more sustainable as companies, we still see constantly driving purchases.
That's really interesting, especially given the change in the supply chain piece that you mentioned right before that. I would think that given some of those headwinds, it would be really hard for these companies to continue to prioritize that. How are you kind of seeing that play out?
Yeah, you know, again, there's lots of speculation and rumor that sustainability is dropping. We're not seeing that in terms of people's behavior. And actually, it's somewhat a little bit of a silver lining as people need to shift their supply chains, right, from big global to more regional and more suppliers. In some cases, they're investing in more sustainable agriculture, as an example, bringing new people into the supply chain that weren't participating before, which enables you to be more sustainable, bring more diversity into supply chain. So in some ways, they're actually very aligned. Or also the case where you're doing more reuse, you know, and circular economy actually brings down costs, helps supply chain resiliency, and improves sustainability.
Your sweet spot for SAP is mid-market, which, you know, the big, you know, large cap companies often get a lot of the headlines, a lot of the attention. But tell us about the mid-cap space, which I think, just like small caps, tells us so much about the economy.
Yeah, thank you for asking this. Most people think SAP only serves the biggest of the world's companies, which we do. But the majority of our customers are actually mid-market. And, you know, the things that we're seeing hit big companies amplify when we talk to our mid-market customers, right? When they have little fluxes in revenue, and it can have devastating impacts on their bottom line. And so working with them on how they manage inflation, better management on cash flow, better business planning. And the nice thing about cloud technology is it gives any size customer, but mid-market customers, access to the same sophisticated business process tools as a big company, right? So it really has a democratizing effect to it. So we're able to really help mid-market in the ways we help big customers, but in a way that's more agile and cost-effective for them.
What would you say is one of the biggest mistakes that you see some of these, not to put it on them, but some of these mid-sized companies making when they are struggling and they don't necessarily have access to the tools that you offer yet?
Yeah, I think that the biggest mistake is they spend too long running their company on Excel. And they, you know, again, they're moving fast, they're trying to be efficient, but they don't realize what they're missing out on. And, you know, I was actually just recently working with a kind of mid-sized chemical company, and they'd waited a long time to move into automation of business processes, which is just helps a lot of around efficiency and decision making. And, you know, once they'd spent the time to, you know, implement some more modern, you know, enterprise resource management, they were able to react much more quickly, and they saw immediate results. But, you know, they had to go through that journey to get there. And then in retrospect, they're like, oh, we should have done this earlier. But it takes time and focus.
It does remind me a little bit, and we don't have to get into this, but it reminds me of FTX using QuickBooks. When we all found that out, we were like, oh my God, how did you have such a huge company and do that? But then we talked to these startup guys who are like, if you have a big idea, just make it happen and do it. But it sounds like I'm hearing from you that you do need to focus on the bones and the infrastructure a little bit as well.
Yeah, really thinking about all these processes. Yeah, they're getting it done, but at what cost, and what are they not getting? And it's oftentimes hard to see the opportunity cost or the missed cost of what they're doing. But as we work with them, and part of it too is it used to be, I mean, big and hard and expensive to deploy an, you know, an ERP or, you know, enterprise resource process, right? It used to be on premises, but now the cloud changes that so fundamentally. But I think a lot of mid-market customers are still coming to realize that actually, I can get a really robust enterprise resource system in place in a couple of months. You know, it's not 3 years and $300 million anymore.
Julia, tell us about, just got about a minute or so left here, the feedback loop. So in other words, you're talking with your clients and customers, you're saying that these organizations are feeling the impact of a downturn in the economy. So you say about value with, you know, fewer resources. So how do you go back to your creative team or your engineers, when your solutions team, and say, hey, here's what we need to be doing because this is what the customer demands?
Yeah, I think the things that the big trends we're hearing from our customers are automation, which means, you know, using AI to identify where there's inefficiencies and automating that out, and helping the customer be much more predictive with what's next, right? Like the world's changing fast, and all of our crystal balls are kind of imperfect these days. And so that agility to do different kinds of predictive planning is the
generative AI move kind of impacting you guys all of a sudden? Because it does seem like it's all of a sudden on everybody's radar, although we know it's not brand new.
Yeah, it has, but it has definitely, you know, hugely revolutionary opportunities with it. So absolutely, looking at how we use it in a bunch of our different products, whether it's HR and onboarding to customer engagement.
All right, going to leave it there. Hey, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Julia White, she's Chief Marketing and Solutions Officer at SAP, joining us via Zoom from Seattle.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm so delighted at our next guest. Looking forward to bringing him in because we want to talk a little bit about the startup world. Bloomberg has reported AI has been one of the only sectors where startups with little or to no revenue have raised huge funding hauls, even in an environment where checks are hard to come by. We talked about it, ChatGPT, just with our Brad Stone. So we wanted to get some thoughts about the startup world, and we bring in someone who has built two unicorns. So great to have back with us, and here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, Ori Levine. He is co-founder of Waze. They, of course, were sold to Google for more than $1 billion back in 2013. He was an investor in MoveIt, which Intel bought for $1 billion back in 2020. His book, which we recently talked about, is Fall in Love with the Problem, Not the Solution, a handbook for entrepreneurs. Ori, so great to have you here with Maddie and myself. How are you?
Thank you. Really happy to be here. I'm excellent.
We're so glad to have you back with us. So much to talk about. We've got two nice long chunks of time to do it. Talk to us about the startup world right now and how you see it, because there is a lot of attention on AI and generative AI, courtesy of that Microsoft investment. How do you see it? How do you think about it?
So look, startups are here to stay, right? At the end of the day, there are many startups that are starting from the problem and trying to create value through solving a problem, and they are here to stay. And at the same time, we have seen in the recent years some overinflated valuation that created some tensions with the bearish market that we are experiencing in general.
And was it just because there was so much money floating around out there?
Part of it is yes, right? And so for a certain extent, I would say when you are being overwhelmed with the amount of money, then you are actually urged to spend it in order to show progress. And the result is that you might be spending it on the wrong things.
I love to hear you explain it in such a simple way, but the way that I always think about it is just that's how you get a WeWork is always what I think about because I'm obsessed with that story. What do you think is, given that, do you think that maybe in a higher interest rate environment might actually be good news for the startup world?
At the end of the day, the higher interest rate is in order to fight inflation. And over the years, we have seen that that sort of medicine actually works, right? And so we are likely to see that until we will see some sort of a slowdown in the market, and then interest rates will start to go down again, and growth is going to come back.
But does it make it harder to get funding, right?
Look, I describe building a startup in three dimensions, right? It's a long roller coaster journey of failures. And it's always like that, right? Now, if you add to that, on top of that, the environment that is making it even tougher, and I would call fundraising as a roller coaster in the dark. You don't even know what's coming. And these days, it's longer and it's harder, but it was longer and harder before as well.
Or how many times did people say no, 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 no?
Hundreds of times. Hundreds of times.
How difficult was it? And were there times you were like, I'm out of here?
You know, one of the things that is going to make entrepreneurs successful is the grit, is mm-hmm. the never give up attitude, right? And so you will hear no so many times, and you might be going home crying, but it will never discourage you from your mission.
So you kept at it. Obviously, many times. But it is interesting because money, support, all these things are necessary. I mean, was there a moment, whether it was Waze or something else, where you were just like, gosh, you know, we've got a couple of days left or a couple of weeks left of money or something where you realize something's got to change positively in our direction? Or did it never get to that point?
I would say that, you know, with Waze and MoveIt and 10 of other startups that I was involved at, in all of them, throughout the journey, we ran into the near the end situation, right? Really close to the end situation. And in most of it, we will recover, right? So at the end of the day, look, the persistency and the value that you create is going to be paid back. Now, if you don't create value, if you don't solve a problem, if you don't figure out product market fit, you will die. Unfortunately, you will die.
You can't just create, right? It's got to have a reason to exist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And real value. I do wonder if we can also just go back to the idea of all of the no's in the room really quickly, because it's such a great point and question, Carol. I wonder if you can talk about the challenge of maybe not being part of the Silicon Valley bro community straight away. Like, a lot of times we talk about this, the VC folks who all went to Stanford together, investing in one another, and you come from a little bit of a different background. Was that an added challenge for you?
So for a second, I would say Israel might be even a better ecosystem than the Silicon Valley for startups, right? And so Israel occasionally called Startup Nation, and there is a good reason for that. The ecosystem is actually very supportive and very powerful. And so there are, at the end of the day, there are more startups per capita in Israel than there are in other places in the world. And it turns out to be working beautifully, right? At the end of the day, if you start in Israel, you might have equal likelihood of being successful than if you start in the Silicon Valley.
How come? Talk to us a little bit. Like, because I feel like we've talked a lot over the decade and then some about how, what a great incubator Israel is for so many different types of companies and technologies. So what is the difference? I think we just assume everything is Silicon Valley still in terms of the narrative. But what are the differences? What is it about the environment in Israel that attracts or makes it such a fertile ground for startups and ideas?
So I would start with generalizations, right? So at the end of the day, what you want to have in an ecosystem that supports startups are actually four cornerstones, right? So entrepreneurs, investors, and then engineers and experience. These are the four cornerstones. And entrepreneurs will usually go into this journey if the fear of failure is low. And the fear of failure is low in the Silicon Valley, and it's low in Israel. And it's actually high in many other places. People are afraid to fail. The supportive of the investors is critical. It's the fuel of the ecosystem, right? And so you need to have regulations that enables that, and in many cases you need to encourage them. But at the end of the day, if you invest in Silicon Valley or you invest in Israel, from taxation point of view, it's going to be the same. So really allowing the same thing. Engineers, a lot of engineers in Israel, and experience. And one of the things that actually growing rapidly in Israel, more and more entrepreneurs are paying it forward to the community. I'm doing that through the book that I'm trying to help entrepreneurs to become more successful. But the major difference is actually reside someplace else. Israel is in a tough neighborhood. And when you grow up in a tough neighborhood,
talk about grit.
You grew up tough, right? And so military service is mandatory in Israel. And the result is, during your 3 years of military service, you realize that giving up is not an option. And you realize how to build and work in teams. And the loyalty and commitment that you have to the mission is way greater. And these actually makes the Israeli ecosystem so unique.
Did you find, we've only got about 30, 40 seconds, and then we'll come back and continue the conversation, but your military experience, were you often in your pursuit of your companies and building of your companies drawing on your experiences?
So that was a long time ago, right?
But you know what I'm saying.
But yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Shapes you,
and you know, at the end of the day, I have some friends that I've been doing the military service with them, and they are now, in different startups of mine. And obviously, you realize that there are a lot of things that you have learned over there, and you don't pay attention that you've learned them there.
We are here with Ori Levine, co-founder of Waze, and also
which
author.
Which you said changed your life.
Which changed my life completely, because I was living in Los Angeles at the time, driving to my like weird internships at 4 a.m. and having Waze help me navigate the city. So it was very, very critical for me. But Ori, I want to talk about how the tech has changed, because what I think makes Waze so interesting is how much it relies on the community, of course, to help you understand where the bad traffic is and where things are you know, difficult that should be avoided. How have you seen that community-driven technology change over the course of your career?
So crowdsource is a method that is not widely used, but at the end of the day, it's the best way to actually gather information and gather data, right? So occasionally we are doing that because we are looking at the general behavior. But the case of Waze is really unique because we have created a paid forward social network of drivers, right? So you report back to the rest of the drivers and help them to avoid traffic jams, to avoid speed traps, to avoid accidents and so forth. And in return, you are doing the same for the drivers behind you. And so this magic that we help the rest of the drivers actually turns out to work beautifully and created the best driving tool there is.
Do you think that other big tech companies, social media companies, could learn a lesson from that? Like, we talk a lot about the challenges of social media companies, Instagram, the way that it's impacting young people, et cetera. Do you think that other big tech companies could learn from that community helping each other energy?
So I think that Waze is all goodness. In some of the other social networks, it's not necessarily the case, right? And occasionally we are seeing overuse by, in particular, younger generations. And you look at it from the outside and you say, no, there is something wrong here, right? It's nearly impossible that they're spending so much time, or this is so important for them that they might be living or dying by that. And I think that the essence of all businesses in the world should be very simple: create value. And then the value that you are going to get out of that is a derivative of the value that you create.
You know, the thing I love, and I've talked with Kathy Wood a lot of ARK Invest, you know, this whole idea of innovation disruption, and I think it gets thrown around a lot, but this whole idea of a company like yourself, like creating Waze, totally went after the establishment and changed the way we do things. Uber did it with driving, right? And getting a car. It's like, just there are better ways, different ways, substantially changing the way we live and work, if you will. How do you look out at the future, and what kind of catches your attention about things that you think, okay, this too could really change the way we do things in a better way?
So you're right. Disruption is not about technology. It's about changing behavior, and at the end of the day, changing the market equilibrium. Now, if you look at the pace of innovation, and if we will have a time machine, and I will send you back into 2007, that means that I'm going to take away Waze from you, and Uber, and your iPhone, and Netflix, and pretty much everything that you're using every day, right? So it's unclear that we will survive, right?
Right.
This is how fast things are changing. In fact, if you try to ask yourself, so what does it mean about the future? So for a second, I will make the following statement, right? A decade from now, if you think of the top 10 companies of the world, right? So Apple and Amazon and Microsoft and Google and Facebook and Tesla and whatever, and ask yourself, which one is going to be in the top 10 a decade from now? Now, the answer is that we don't know. But only five. If we would know, then I will tell you, you know what? Sell short on those that are not, and this is it, right? And we are done. But we don't know. The more interesting perspective is going to be which companies are going to take their place in the top 10. Some of those, you haven't heard the name yet. Mm-hmm. This is how fast things are changing, right? So in particular, you look at AI today and you say, wait a minute, this is actually entering into our radar 2 months ago, right? Before that, you never heard about ChatGPT or GPT in general, even though that the technology is being developed for a long while now.
But
all of a sudden, we are experiencing some sort of change of behaviors, right? And the change of behavior is not whether or not the technology is good or not good, or good enough or not good enough. It's not about that. It's about the fact that there are some people that are going to ChatGPT before they go to Google. And when this happens, that changed the behavior, right? Now, in reality, you would say, wait a minute, it's not good enough. And actually, instead of getting multiple perspectives on the search of Google, and then you can actually choose the one that makes sense for you, you're going to get one. And it's going to be written in a beautiful way that it makes perfect sense, even though that it might not.
Right.
But it's still the case, right? Now, the reality is that you look around it and what happened in the market and you say, wait a minute, Google just announced their own, right? So obviously they haven't built it in the last 2 months, right? Mm. They have built it for a long while. And now they realize that maybe even if it's not ready, we have to go to the market with that, because otherwise we might be missing the opportunity here. And they're not the only one, right? So all of a sudden there is a realization that, okay, change is likely to happen in the market in the way that we are generating text, possibly searching for information, definitely. Mm-hmm. because you're going to get nicer results, right? If you search Google, you're going to get whatever some other actually generated in a single web page. But if you use the language regeneration, then you're going to end with something that is written beautifully, and you might like it.
So all the time that we're spending since Microsoft, the news of Microsoft and their investment has come out, it's smart for us to be focusing on this because there's a lot of smart companies that are focusing on this. And so it has the power to dramatically impact our behavior, or already is.
In my mind, definitely yes.
Okay.
And it's still a long journey for ChatGPT and anyone else that is doing AI and GPT language regeneration. There is still a long way to go.
So if Google hired you right now as a consultant specifically on its rollout of its ChatGPT, what would your biggest piece of advice be about how they could corner that area of the market?
Faster,
even if it's not good.
Look, everything that you go to the market, you go with something that is not ready, right? You go with not good enough first, and then you iterate with the feedbacks that you get from the users.
Software does this all the time, right? They throw it out there and we all play with it.
Waze was not good enough at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
So and there were multiple iterations until it became good enough. And when it's good enough, then this is where you are going to win the market. So at the end of the day, now they could have done that faster, right? But they actually look at the disruption as a threat. And the real way to look at disruption is as an opportunity. Because if you take Uber, for example, Uber is an amazing example of disruption. Before that, we only had taxi drivers. Mm-hmm, that's it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the market today is 10 times bigger than it was before. 10 times bigger for on-demand trips, right? In this 10 times bigger market, there is room for Uber and Lyft and Grab and 99 Taxi, and there is 3 times bigger room for taxi drivers. So disruption is actually creating an opportunity, because what we are saying about disruption is that it changed the market equilibrium. Now, by definition, the market equilibrium, the new one, is better than the previous one, because otherwise the market will not go there.
Yeah, no, it's really fascinating, right? It didn't just displace, it actually grew a market size.
Exactly.
And access and behavior. So people who didn't necessarily order cars to do things, all of a sudden they could.
Exactly.
So interesting, Ori. So, go.
20 seconds, 30 seconds, what's the next problem you're working on? Gotta be quick.
So, I'm really proud of my books. Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, called that the Bible for entrepreneurs, and I think that this is going to have a bigger impact than all of my startups, because it's going to help entrepreneurs to become more successful.
We were saying a lot of people didn't have a playbook, right? And now they do have a playbook, thanks to you. The book is called Fall in Love with the Problem, Not the Solution, a Handbook for Entrepreneurs. Ori, it was so great to have you back in studios. Welcome anytime, so come back soon.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Ori Levine, he's co-founder of Waze, as we mentioned, that book, Fall in Love with the Problem, Not the Solution, a Handbook for Entrepreneurs. But it's so true, right? Figure out a problem.
Yeah.
Watch the market size, or look for the market, and then go at it. Or, of course, in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I did come across a research note that talked about online gambling in the betting market globally, the size and share to exceed $114 billion by 2028, growing at a compound annual growth rate of nearly 11%. So we've got a great guest to talk about it. He's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Charles Gillespie, is co-founder and CEO of the publicly traded small cap gambling.com group limited. They operate in US, Ireland, and Malta. They are across the globe. You might know some of their sites, including gambling.com, bookies.com, and rotowire.com. Again, like I said, he's in studio with Maddie and myself. How are you?
I'm very well. Happy to be here today.
Well, tell us a little bit about your business and the industry and what you're seeing in the last year or so.
Our business is doing very well, and the entire industry over the last several years has shifted its focus away from Europe, which is kind of the historical home of regulated gambling, toward the United States, as the U.S. has become the center of gravity in this global industry. And the growth has just been phenomenal.
You know, what's phenomenal? Give us an idea. Can you give us some ballparks?
Well, you've got, I think it's already up to something like $10 billion in the U.S. And if you look back 3, 4, 5 years, it was sub $1 billion.
But what kind of growth are you seeing on your sites?
Well, we delivered growth of 100% and nearly 100% in Q3 in the U.S. And the U.S. has been huge for us. You know, it's really, you know, our story kind of mirrors the global story for the industry. When we started the business,
coming off of lower levels, is that fair?
Exactly. You know, coming off of essentially nothing, you know, four or five years ago. When we started this business back in the day, there was no regulated online gambling in the United States. So we left and we ended up building one of the most important affiliate marketing businesses in the industry based in Europe with our biggest office in Ireland and our biggest markets really being the UK and Ireland. And then slow and steady, things started to change in the U.S. You know, you actually got online casino gaming in New Jersey nearly 10 years ago already. And that was a big deal.
Huge.
But we didn't really see that, you know, spreading across the United States 10 years ago. And it didn't. It took a number of years before the dam broke. And the dam broke in 2018 when the Supreme Court issued a ruling that invalidated this 1990s era sports betting ban, and that created the climate for what we've seen today with regulated sports betting now rolling out, you know, across the U.S. 20 plus states already with online sports betting, and you know it's a states' rights issue, right? So each individual state is free to kind of do it the way they want, and
is your growth basically just banking on that, like just the growth going across the United States?
Yeah, we had a profitable, high-margin, high-growth business before any of this. Mm-hmm. And then you layer on this incredible growth in the United States, and it, you know, it obviously gets very, very exciting. New York sports betting regulated, you know, over a year ago already. That was the biggest launch to date in the United States. But the real prize that's going to come for the industry here is online casino games, right? Which is, frankly, has a very different margin profile. You know, if you think about sports betting, it's actually quite a low margin product.
What is it typically? I don't know a ton about this industry. I mean, I know generally, but so what's the margin in the sports betting?
Well, if you think about it this way, think about player values. You know, an online sports betting player is worth, you know, probably 1,000 to 2,000 plus, depending on the operator and
like
how
that's
well.
How much they're betting. What do you mean by that?
That's what the lifetime value of the player would be to the online gambling operator that gets them through the door.
Got it.
And you know, we're in the business of referring players to the operators, right? So they pay us something. They don't pay us the entire lifetime value of the player, of course, but it's a very healthy proportion of that. And when you compare sports betting to online casino. Online casino is roughly twice the value, okay? Of course, there's not as many people that play online casino as bet on sports. It's a more kind of niche product where sports betting is quite, you know, mass market. Everybody can wrap their head around sports betting.
But in online casino, the volume, I would assume, like there are people who just play it over and over again.
Absolutely, and you know, that's how the gambling industry works. It's
why the house
part of it is the odds.
Yeah.
Part of it is that house edge, but you know, the other part of it, which people forget, is it's how many times you pull that lever.
Yeah.
If you only pull it once, even if the house edge is very high, it's not such a brilliant business. But if you pull that lever a lot, even if the house edge is very, very low, like it is in slots, it's a fantastic business.
And make it up on just the frequency.
Yeah.
Where does the macroeconomic issue come into play with that? Because, you know, we keep talking about whether or not we're heading to a recession this year. Is that concerning for the gambling industry?
No.
Do people gamble more when the economy's bad?
It's not that people gamble more. It's that the activity is largely resilient to the economy, even in fairly mature online gambling markets. You know, you look at the UK, which has had regulated online gambling for 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, and even in the UK, it's still growing by 8 or 9% a year. And in the US, the growth is so spectacular that any sort of headwind, which there isn't really, but even if there was a headwind, you probably wouldn't even see it.
And you don't feel
it. You wouldn't feel it given the overall growth.
What's the biggest thing in the U.S. that drives people then? Like for the Rihanna concert that some people call the Super Bowl, was that a huge push for you guys? Is it stuff like that?
Absolutely. Player acquisition around sports betting is very event driven. And, you know, there is no bigger event than the sport than the Super Bowl. So, yeah. March Madness is also coming up in a very, very important time of the year for player acquisition.
Charles, how many people, these player acquisitions, could be you, could be me, could be
us, Carol.
Exactly. How many come in like on the Super Bowl? Can you give us an idea, range?
Well, you know, companies like ours would refer, in any given month, we're referring, you know, over 10,000 new depositing customers.
On average.
I mean, sometimes it's substantially more than that.
Right.
But when you think about our business model, the online gambling operators, they only pay us when we've delivered a customer to their door who has signed up, been verified, has deposited, and has made a bet in a regulated state. So the value proposition we provide to them is crystal clear. And you know, there's a lot of talk these days about...
So you've checked all those boxes before you pass them on.
Well, that's their job. They need to do that. But they don't owe us any money until they've cleared all those checks.
Do most of those people clear?
No.
What percent? Is it like half? I'm just curious. Like, is it half?
It's tough to speak to, you know, each step in the process, okay. One of the issues is a lot of people sign up, but they're not in a regulated state. You know,
right.
if you're in California and you sign up for DraftKings, you can't bet, you know, and that, you know, but if you hop on a plane and you come to New York for whatever reason, then you can. So, yeah. A lot of it is really education and historically there's been challenges with payments, you know, especially a couple of years ago, a lot of U.S. banks just did not differentiate between illegal offshore online gambling and actually regulated tax-paying legal onshore gambling.
So you said on average about 10,000 that you're passing on.
It's usually on a... It could be a lot more than that in any given month.
But on Super Bowl, so like at a Super Bowl leading up to the Super Bowl, is it five times that amount? I understand over a lot it's going to even out, but
yeah,
or if it's March Madness,
substantially more. We haven't even reported.
We're Bloomberg. Did they tell you we like numbers?
We love a number. Just kidding.
We'll report Q4 on March 23, and we'll give a little color on Q1 at that point as well. I'm sure.
20 seconds left. It sounds very rosy. You seem like growth is coming, especially as regulations ease. 20 seconds. What is the one tricky thing for you in your business?
If there's any headwind at all, it's, inflation, right? Talent is expensive our business runs on people. You know, we do everything
like
we can.
Workers and wages are expensive for
you? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, That's not good for the Fed. Yeah.
But we've got people all around the world, so we can manage that by hiring in lower cost jurisdictions if necessary.
It's something we've heard from every head of a company.
Yep.
It's all about workers and finding them and then being able to pay them. Charles Gillespie, come back soon. That was really fun. Co-founder, CEO of Gambling.com Group here in our Interactive Brokers studio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're going to get right to it, Maddie, because season 8 of Bar Rescue debuts this weekend on the Paramount Network. My husband and I, we definitely have binged on Bar Rescue in the past. Back with us is John Taffer. He's host and executive producer of Bar Rescue, creator of his own restaurant franchise concept. It's called Taffer's Tavern. They're in Georgia, they're in Maryland and D.C., and they are growing. He is here back with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So nice to have you here. I feel like we're getting back to normal.
I feel that way, too, but not quite. There are things that aren't happening yet that need to.
You came in and you're like, I got to share something with you. Tell us what's going on. Why are things not quite back to normal, John?
Well, you know, in my life, outside of television, in my practice, I help independent operations and I help large corporations. So I get a good perspective of both sides of that fence.
Right.
There's a tentativeness out there. Operators have been stung a little bit. When we used to make bold decisions, we're not quite making bold decisions right now. We've sort of stepped back in this conservative mode, if you will.
Right.
We're a little scared of employees. We can't lose them. We can't find them. They're sort of in control of the moment a little more than we are at times. That's concerning. Our costs are concerning. And then we're all facing this issue of value proposition, Carolyn. What I mean by that is if my steak goes up in cost $3,
yeah,
I got to charge you $9 more. Because my cost is one third. Mm-hmm. So here we're getting increases in chicken breast and in all these products, $1 or $2, $1 or $2. But for us, it's a significant impact on the value proposition of our restaurants. So we're fighting that value proposition. We're dealing with the employees and we're stung. So the industry isn't rising at the level I was hoping it would,
right,
because of this tentativeness.
So meaning what? They're not opening up new establishments? What does that lead to, John?
You know, it's not only opening new establishments, it's taking bold steps into promotions, new day parts, new menu items, new creativity, new marketing programs, all the things that we would do to energize and keep our concepts fresh and entertaining. None of that seems to be happening right now.
What's the biggest mistake that you see people making of all of those that you mentioned that you miss?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's this view today that the customer will understand. Right. Customers know that we're short staffed. They're going to understand. Customers know that our prices are going up.
Yeah.
They're going to understand. I worry, Madison, how long that understanding is going to carry for. You know, there's inflationary impact. And I was talking earlier today. I just read an article this morning. Supermarket inflation is about 11%. Mm-hmm. Restaurant inflation is sitting at about 8%.
Mm-hmm.
So in theory, comparatively, one could say, boy, the value might be greater at a restaurant today than at a supermarket, in a sense.
Right.
But it's not being realized at the rate that it should. And it's very concerning.
Well, I mean, so what... If that continues, John, what is the longer term impact? You know, it's interesting. Our Kate Crater, who is our food critic here, and she said pre-pandemic, like it was just an explosion in the restaurant. It was called, I forget what you call it, like the golden age of restaurants. Mm-hmm. And just people were trying new ideas and throwing things out. Pandemic hits. It's obviously a very different environment. And as you say, we're coming off and you're feeling this tentativeness. If it persists, then what longer term do you see happening potentially?
I see flatter revenues long term.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's innovation
eventually
that elevates us, right?
Yeah.
So when we're not having the innovation, when we're not having the depth of employee, the concentration of management, all these things take their effect on us. Kind of concerns me a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, that boomtown.
You do feel subdued.
Yes. But that boomtown that you were talking about was a height of innovation.
Right.
New concepts, new chefs, new things were abound everywhere. Not so much now.
And it's just not the same experience, right? And this is such a privileged position to be in. I'm in New York. There's a great restaurant in every corner, but it doesn't feel the same. I feel like I'm paying more to be there for a longer amount of time, not necessarily get everything that I want, right? Yeah. Do you have a timeline for when I can get my great New York City restaurant vibes back?
You know, it's funny. I was staying, and I won't say the brand, at a very high-end luxury hotel, about as high-end as you can get.
In New York?
This is a few weeks ago, yes.
Oh, okay.
And my breakfast room service came in a cardboard box. No plates.
You didn't like that.
And it's like I was in the middle of the pandemic. So I called up the general manager and I said, when do you become a great hotel again? When does that happen? Yeah. Is it next month? Is it 6 months from now?
And we're being serious.
Like, I'm being dead serious. Yeah. When do we make that commitment as an industry to say no more? We have to get back to normal. I think that's a very powerful question, Madison. I wish I knew the answer to it. Yeah. At some point, you're going to get disgusted. And you're going to go where you're taken care of and you feel better. That's my concern.
Yeah, it does feel like I've been places too. And I'm like, wait, we're kind of out of the pandemic. Although we did talk to our team over at Hopkins earlier today, reminding that we're not completely out of it. But it does feel like people are still falling back on those ways. And it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, we should kind of go back. Is it just because they're still looking to save costs or what?
I think it's just
because some say they don't have the staff to do everything that they'd like to.
Think about somebody who owns a business for years. They believe their life is stable. Mm-hmm. This pandemic comes along. Now they're not stable. Yeah. The instability is very fearsome to them.
Right.
Now we're coming out of the pandemic, but the fear isn't gone yet. And I think it takes time for that fear to sort of heal a little bit, Carol, you know, and then to get to that point of decisive decisions again. And I think the economic environment worries us. I think the international environment worries us. I mean, there's a lot of things to be concerned about if you want to strategically look forward.
Right. John, you know, what's great about you, as you say, you're talking to the mom and pops who own bars and restaurants. You're talking to the big, you know, businesses out there that all, you know, own multiple establishments. Do those conversations often involve talking about recession right now?
Yes.
They do. Because it's fascinating, our market conversations, where so many people are like, nah, we're just going to miss it, or it's going to be soft landing with no landing. You're hearing recession a lot.
I still hear the word recession quite a bit. And I hear it, of course.
High end, low end, mid end, what?
I hear it mid end.
Okay.
Mid end. Higher end, that I think that there's more of an economic concern with regard to inflationary impact, supply side impact, which is still a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, a restaurant, if you get a certain hamburger style, your bun is sized for that. Your plate is sized for that. Now you can't get that hamburger. You get a smaller hamburger. Doesn't fit on the bun. Doesn't fit on the plate.
Right.
Here's a good one for you. You'll get a kick out of this. Those little ketchup packets. They were up at 40 cents for a while.
Yeah. There was the shortage, too.
Now restaurants have to buy plastic cups, get ketchup, squirt it in a plastic cup, and now the plastic cup doesn't fit on the plate with the French fry. These little things become big deals when you're in a production business.
Yeah.
And these subtleties become nightmares.
I talked to the owner of a taco restaurant in Dallas, and he told me that the millennial obsession with Topo Chico was like ruining his business because it got so expensive because of the glass shortage. And he would just get wiped out of it all the time, but didn't want to raise the price too much. If you were giving that restaurant owner advice, what would you say?
You know, it's funny. I did a rescue this season of a guy who's losing $2 a hamburger.
Yeah.
And he's proud of the fact that he's selling 100 hamburgers a day. I say, you'd be better off if you sold no hamburgers.
Yeah.
That's what I would tell him.
Yeah.
We're here to make money.
Well,
so we have to raise the prices. It needs to be reasonable. You know, JCPenney, I love a quote that he said, if you don't take care of the customers, you lose the customers. If you don't take care of the business, you lose the business.
So I have to say, I wrote notes. I'm always shocked. Here, I'm going to read. On the generous pours that are done, like as I watch your show, and you have the technology that measures it in an instant, and the thousands of dollars that go out of a business, it seems like such an easy fix, right? So people are basically bartenders overpouring, right? I'm serious.
No, I know. Yeah.
So I'm like, is it that easy a fix for most establishments, John, that if they just...
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
I'm always blown away by
it. We have the systems now.
Yeah.
We have devices that we stick to the bottom of a liquor bottle when you buy it.
Oh, wow.
And it goes into the supply room.
I forget what it's called.
When you pick it up and put it and bring it to the bar, on the map on your tablet, you see the bottle on its way to the bar. Now it's at the bar. Every time they pour it, I know exactly how much they're pouring from it. So all these systems are in place.
But it doesn't match up with the dollars that are ultimately
Absolutely. The
collected.
Consumption and the usage, the consumption and the sales don't match, right?
It's amazing.
You consumed 100 drinks, but you only sold 30.
Right. And the owners, when they hear the thousands of dollars that are going out, that sometimes add up to hundreds of or $100,000 or whatever for the year. 30 seconds left, John. Unfortunately, season 8, what can we expect?
Oh, boy, this is a tough one. You know, last season, pandemic was a valid excuse.
Yeah.
This year, we were just talking about the lack of aggressiveness, of assertiveness. They need a kick in the butt.
Yeah.
I mean, customer traffic is up 20% or more. This is the time. Yeah. Seize this.
Right, step up.
But they're not. So it's a very aggressive season, Carol, but I think I changed a lot of lives this year.
I love hearing that. It's really fun. It's small business. I talked earlier about the backbone of our country is these small businesses. So I'd love to kind of watch and keep an eye on it. John, thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you. Good to see you again. Always good to be here.
Always good. Good luck with the season. John Taffer, host and executive producer of Bar Rescue, joining us in our Interactive Broker studio. What a delight. Be well. Travel well.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, we do want to get to one of the big stories of the day, and it certainly was news coming off of the weekend, and I feel like it's something, you know, Maddie, that we've talked about before when it comes to China and the coronavirus.
Yeah, it's a really critical story. The idea that China's government rejected a U.S. Energy Department assessment that the COVID-19 pandemic likely originated with a lab leak. The Energy Department, which had previously been undecided on the origins of the pandemic, joined the FBI saying the virus likely spread via a mishap, and the Wall Street Journal reported exactly that yesterday.
Well, our next guest had talked about this back in April of 2020. He came out saying that the most likely starting point of the coronavirus crisis was an accidental leak from one of the Chinese virology institutes in Wuhan. Great to have back with us Jamie Metzl, founder and chair of the global social movement One Shared World, an Atlantic Council senior fellow. He's worked at the U.S. National Security Council, the State Department, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So much. You should check out his bio. We're so delighted to have back with us Jamie. He joins us via Zoom. Jamie, it is good to have you here with Maddie and myself. You saw this headline. You've been front and center for a long time about the virus and where it came from. To see that journal headline, tell me how you're thinking about this, to see it once again in the headlines.
Well, Carol, it's nice to speak with you again. You and I have been talking about this for years now. As you said when introing me, from the earliest days of the pandemic, it was pretty clear that a lab origin was at least a very serious hypothesis that needed to be fully investigated. And now, with more and more, albeit circumstantial evidence, it seems that the weight of the available evidence, which is imperfect, is leaning increasingly toward a possible lab origin of the pandemic. That doesn't mean a bioweapon. It means a lab accident, and obviously then followed by what I've been calling a criminal cover-up. The Department of Energy has America's leading national laboratories. Many of your listeners will have heard of the Lawrence Livermore National Lab. They have some of the top scientists in the world, and it's fantastic that they have been continuing to investigate, and they have shifted their perspective toward believing that a lab origin is more likely than not, which is, of course, what I've always believed.
What would you say is the single biggest piece of evidence that makes you feel, like you said, that it was a lab accident and a mistake and not necessarily something more intentional?
So it just wouldn't make sense. It's just logic. If China was developing a bioweapon and then intentionally released it, everybody knows that you can't control a deadly pathogen like this. It just wouldn't make sense. And we don't need to bend over backwards. We can use Occam's razor in trying to understand what happened, because we know that the SARS-CoV-2 virus ancestrally comes from a type of horseshoe bats that don't exist in Wuhan. Their natural habitat is more than 1,000 miles away. Mm-hmm. We know that the Wuhan Institute of Virology had the world's largest collection in the laboratory of SARS-like viruses. We know that they were doing basically research and experiments attaching furin cleavage sites able to infect human cells to SARS-like viruses. And then in the exact city where they're doing exactly that, we have an outbreak of a virus exactly like what they were intending to create, not to release, but I'm guessing as part of a research program with the intention of developing some kind of pan-coronavirus vaccine. And so I don't know if you or your listeners heard that the entertaining rant of Jon Stewart on the Colbert Show, but he says, wait a second, the virus and the lab have the same name. I mean, his was very, very funny, but it's just, it's an unimaginable coincidence that this could happen in the same place. And the more that we've learned, the more it's just seemed, for me, more likely than not that this does come from a lab origin.
Jamie, why is it important for us to know exactly where this virus came from?
It's a really important question, Carol, because some people could say, well, maybe it came from a market, maybe it came from a lab, let's have better lab safety and let's try to restrict the wildlife trade. If that were the case, every time a plane crashed, we would say, hey, another plane crashed, let's redouble our efforts in airline safety. There's a reason why we try to overturn every stone understanding why a plane crashed, because we know that's a very, very real problem. If we don't fix it, it's going to happen again. If, for example, we knew tomorrow that COVID stems from a lab accident in Wuhan, that would supercharge our efforts to regulate the proliferating high containment virology labs around the world. China is building a level 4 lab in every one of its provinces. And right now, our safety and security, you can hear I'm in New York with these sirens in the background, our safety and security depend on the regulators and norms and other behaviors in every country in the world. So if we're here in New York, there's a regulator or a non-regulator in Uzbekistan who is or isn't overseeing a virology lab, and our safety and security and lives may depend on what happens there. It's just a crazy way to do things, and that's why understanding what happened will, I think, help focus our efforts to prevent these types of tragedies from happening in the future.
Understood. Jamie, why is it also important that China acknowledge that this is how it happened? And I think about this at a time when U.S.-China relations are not great, to say the least, and there's such a need for transparency, to be fair, on both sides.
Yes, so people say, and many people have said this to me, well, let's let bygones be bygones. We're not going to get China to cooperate here. Let's play nice. Let's not criticize them. And maybe, hopefully, they will collaborate in the future. But what I say to that is there is absolutely no way to expect transparency and accountability in the future if we can't have it now after, according to WHO estimates, 15 million people are dead from this entirely avoidable pandemic. Because that's what happened last time with the first SARS, two decades ago. China did this same kind of thing, covering up, lying, and eventually it was forced to tell the truth and forced to investigate. If we say, all right, well, now we're giving China another pass, but next time we really mean it, then next time we're going to see the exact same type of behavior. And we need transparency and accountability, not just from China, but from everybody. And that's why the standard is, our lives are at risk. And whether you're a Democrat or Republican, an American citizen, Chinese citizen, anybody, we all need to push for the highest standards of accountability.
Jamie, good to check in. Come back soon. Jamie Metzl, founder and chair of One Shared World and Atlantic Council senior fellow, and as we said, has worked with the U.S. National Security and the State Department and more. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live on Bloomberg Quick Take every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.